Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org.
Today's topic is about gender dynamics and biological differences between men and women. You ready, Dr. Lyle?
Sure.
All right. In 2005, then president of Harvard, his name is Lawrence Summers. He was in a conference, and the conference was about gender diversity in the subjects of science and engineering. Now, over years, there's always been a difference in the amount of males in science, technology, engineering, and math. There's always been more males there than females. And he was discussing these differences and trying to figure out why that was. And he suggested in his talk, among many other things, and I'm grossly paraphrasing here, but he suggested that males and females have behavioral differences that actually can be explained by biology rather than socialization. In other words, that men and women are different simply because they're men and women, not because they were taught to be masculine or taught to be feminine. Of course, there was a really big political fallout from this, people on both sides kind of arguing whether or not he was correct, and it ultimately was a big mess for him. But in terms of what the actual truth is, what do you think, Dr. Lyle?
Well, first of all, I remember when this happened. I can't believe that it was, did you say 2005?
Mm-hmm.
But, it seems like yesterday to me. I remember it well, and I remember basically thinking, you poor slob, I can't believe that you stuck your foot in this, and bless you for doing so, because he was looking at the same evidence that all of us in the social sciences that are aware were looking at, and he was making a comment that is scientifically utterly, completely non-controversial, and yet socially it was just death. So that guy lost his job as the head of Harvard University, because he had the gall to say something that everybody with a brain can see is true, and yet it goes even deeper than that. There's all of the evidence supports him. There are very significant differences between males and females in humans, and when it comes to their psychology, there are large overlaps, because they're both, they're a great ape. They are a big animal that arose on the African continent over the last couple of million years, and they faced the same predators in the same landscape, and therefore they had to evolve many of the same survival mechanisms. But when it comes to the rest of their psychology, their reproductive psychologies drove the differences in the human brains that are just as significant as the differences that you see in the human bodies. And those differences are quite marked.
Take us through that. What's going on there?
What's going to be happening is that the problems that males and females faced in the Stone Age, which is, just for the benefit of anybody listening, the truth of the matter is that 99.9% of all human life was in the Stone Age. So only the very last sliver of the few thousand years have been out of the Stone Age, but for the vast majority of time, that people have been either humans or proto-humans, in other words, something very close to a modern human, they has been in a Stone Age environment. So people all lived for all time a subsistence level of survival in packs, where they you may not want to call them a pack because that sounds like they're a mindless wolf, but no, they lived in groups, and those groups it was them against the harsh faces of reality, and it was their group of maybe 30 people or 40 people or less, or maybe some more in some cases. But the males and females within those groups faced remarkably different problems. And so men were attempting to ascend dominance hierarchies within a group, and women were actually speaking out of both sides of their mouth as they observed this process. They were encouraging the males sexually, the ones that would rise in dominance hierarchies. They would mate with preferentially with men higher in dominance hierarchies. But at the same time, they were a leveling force socially as much as they could, or a cohesive force trying to smooth over the damaged and bruised egos of men who would lose in various competitions. So women are designed by nature to be very subtle and cohesive around social issues, trying to keep a group together, essentially anticipating anger and conflicts of interest, and trying to mitigate the anger and disruption that goes on with an internally competitive situation. You might think of women as if you look thought of an NBA coach, that they've got 12 big egos all trying to be alpha. Everybody wants more shots, and everybody wants more points, and everybody wants more money. But what the coach is trying to get done is trying to get that team to play together as much as they possibly can for the benefit of the whole group. And so that coach has to be very talented and intuitive psychologically in order to balance these two processes. So that is very much how female psychology has come to be the way it looks. And male psychology is much more direct, forward, and trying to get to the top.
I remember watching a movie, and it was called My Big Fat Greek Wedding, and the man of the house was a big burly male, and he was was trying to be the alpha male of the household. And he told his wife during one scene at dinner, he said, "I'm the man of the house, I'm the head of the household, and you shall treat me like this." And the wife, just kind of snarky way, she said, "Yeah, well, you're the head, but I'm the neck, so I turn the head wherever it goes."
That's beautiful. Yeah.
Is that what we're talking about here?
Well, sure. In other words, they're all trying to angle for resources. In other words, the chief function of life on Earth is to gather resources in order to utilize those resources in service of gene reproduction. That's fundamentally what's happening. So the big strong male is an extremely useful device for a female. Yeah, for two reasons. Number one, they want to pass on big, strong genes to their son, and they also want to get the benefit of those big, strong, gutsy muscles in terms of their hunting capabilities and their protection capabilities. So women are looking to they're actually looking for masculine genes, and males are also looking for effeminate genes, and so these two things are these two timeless methods that the brains have morphed themselves into, and with it substantial differences in their psychologies.
So let's talk a little bit more about the specifics. I know you said that the male psychology is more direct and things like that. What are some unique differences for males?
Well, for one thing, males are much more likely to be explosive, angry, and violent than females. Males actually have a particular hormone called dihydrotestosterone that, when they get angry, this acts like a supercharged testosterone. And so what it does is it fires males up and puts them in a position where they effectively feel that they are all in on a game. on a game where there's potential violence involved. Females don't have this, or if they have it, they have it in massively smaller quantities. It's just males, for example, the average male in the United States will analyze his fighting ability about 3 times a week. Strangely enough, the most common amount of time that a female will analyze her fighting ability in her lifetime is zero. So there will be
females. We're talking about physical, or are we talking about intellectual or emotional?
Physical fights. So most females rarely analyze their fighting abilities, where most males analyze their fight abilities 3 times a week. So this happens.
Tell that to my sister.
Yeah. I barely. You are vaguely aware of it. That if you are, for example, I might walk into a gas station, and I'm in there to possibly pay a gas bill. So I give the guy $20, and in there is a couple of fairly rough-looking customers. Not super rough-looking. They're just there to buy potato chips and beer. But the point is that I'm looking at them, and I'm analyzing their size, and I'm thinking through the situation if this gets violent. This is not the typical life that a female human being lives in. And so it's not that they can't. If they've been assaulted, that may change things, or if they've seen assaults, that may change things, or if they just may have been threatened. But the point is that the average female literally is not living inside the same quasi-violence-filled brain as goes on inside of a human male.
So what are some differences in a female?
They are, for one thing, they're on average, they're quite a bit nicer. And so with the less testosterone, females are inherently friendlier and inherently more motivated to keep the peace. The this doesn't mean that females aren't very crafty. Remember, they may be very nice, but they're all still trying to compete for the top males. And so they are still in sexual competition with one another. And so there's still some clever dynamics, intersexual dynamics that go on with females competing with each other. They don't tend to like the competition. In other words, they're sort of they're a little bit frustrated and resentful that the males even put them in that position. But the truth is that they've got to be in that position, and there's no way around it. Whereas males are a little more straightforward about the fact that they're competing with each other very directly for female attention and favor. And so the females are just a little slicker, a little more subversive. The knives aren't quite as sharp is basically what's going on.
Why are females less direct about their competitive status in the mating game?
What they are in general is they're in general friendlier. Remember what they're up to. They're trying to compete with each other as ferociously as possible to get as high on the mating food chain as they can get. But at the same time, they are trying to keep the pack together. If a pack comes apart because the mating dynamics get too volatile, then the females really lose big. Because they've got a child or two, and they're vulnerable to, for example, a pack on the other side of the river. So if our pack has, say, 23 people in it, and some of them are little children, and we've got eight men and eight women, and so we've got eight men that are basically the protectors of our entire pack. If there's too much conflict of interest between those males over a given female or two, if those females aren't intuitive enough to smooth that thing out and not allow that boat to rock, they could have the pack could get split in half. And if it gets split in half, they are in danger of being overrun and raped and basically, et cetera, being wiped out by a bigger pack that has cohesion. And so it appears that human packs would run probably as big as 150. And so you really didn't want to be the member of a small pack that was a vulnerable place. And female psychology appears to have been essential in trying to keep those packs together. That's where you'll hear about, you know, the people pleasing, the conflict avoidant, the peacemaker. This is where this all comes from. It isn't that males don't have those characteristics; they just don't have them in the same quantities as females do.
Would you say that males who exhibit these type of characteristics, do they just have less testosterone, or are they, I guess, more feminine? I mean, what's the deal with that?
Yeah, they've got less testosterone. Undoubtedly, testosterone isn't the only variable that's involved here, but on average, that's exactly what it is that you're saying. Testosterone is a causal agent, and therefore a pretty strong correlate of male aggressive behavior.
And for females who are, I guess, more direct and less peacekeeping, do they just have more testosterone or less estrogen?
Yes. What's going on here is testosterone to estrogen ratios. And so, for example, males have a testosterone to estrogen ratio, I think, that's 7 times more concentrated in testosterone than females, something of that nature. That doesn't mean that you won't get some pretty tough females along the way, and that have plenty of testosterone in there. So they, and it's a fascinating study was done 50 years ago by a guy named McGargy, who set up a social psychological experiment that had males and females being paired together to do a task, where I think they had to do some report. They were going to report to the group on their task. I do not remember the details of this. But what he did was he was trying to look for the dynamic between males and females when it came to taking charge. And so he had, I believe what he had was 4 combinations. He had dominant male, dominant female paired together. Then he had dominant male, passive female or submissive female. Then he would have submissive male, dominant female, and submissive male, submissive female. And strikingly, in every single case, the male was the dominant figure. So even in submissive male, dominant female, the male was the one that theoretically took the lead. But what happened was, is that the dominant female basically shoved him into it and made him pushed him into sort of being the alpha of that situation. But in all other situations, it very quickly became dominant, or the male became dominant, which would have been, now some people would say, well, that's 1960s and it wouldn't happen now. But I think that these are basically, if someone were to redo the study now, I think they would probably find exactly the same thing. But these are fundamentally pretty solid character of human nature.
A few years ago, there was a writer who was curious about the differences in males and females, and she was a writer who kind of grew up believing that little boys are little boys because the parents give them trucks to play with, and little boys are taught to stare at a woman when she walks past them, and that girls are girls because they're given, you know, the color pink and dresses and Barbie dolls. So she did an experiment, and she was injected the same amount of testosterone as a regular adult, 25-year-old male. And in her blog about this, she describes the feeling she had when an attractive woman walked by her, and it was all she could do to control herself to not turn her head and stare at the body when the woman walked by. And after she was done with her experiment, she said she never got it until that moment, that why she was so upset when men would try really hard not to look at certain things, and then and they just couldn't help themselves.
You know, that's a very strange story, and I don't think I would believe it unless maybe she's a lesbian. Because
she actually is.
Yeah. Okay. Well, now that makes complete sense. Now that makes sense. So, yeah, there would be nothing about injecting testosterone into a female that would cause them to look at females. But yes, if she's a lesbian, then yes, the greater amount of testosterone. Testosterone is a huge driving force of sexuality, and so and this is. this is where the ratio of, actually the ratio of testosterone to estrogens will sort of tell the story. And yes, so she upped her ratio of testosterone considerably, and suddenly she was going to enhance her sexual force and her psychology. And there you had it. There you go. Turn and look.
Yeah, yep.
Look till they're gone.
Yeah. Of course, none of us do this, obviously.
I didn't look at the lady next door as out the window every time she walked by in front of our house. Nope.
No, you would never. That would be rude.
She got about eight. She was old. She was an old lady. She was about 29 years old. Yeah, so... That lady was a 29-year-old 10. Oh, my goodness.
The Stone Age village kind of looks like this, and you've got these females competing for the top males, and the males all competing with each other for the dominating rights. I always just assumed that because males can mate so many times and their sperm is essentially very cheap compared to the amount of eggs that a woman can produce over her lifetime. I think it's something like 400 eggs, and then for men it's probably in the millions, billions, or trillions, that the females will just all go to the top male, no matter what.
Yes, that is turns out not to be the case, and the reason is that in our species now, just to be clear here, that is exactly what happens in 97% of the mammalian species. So there's about 4,000 mammalian species, and about 3,900 of them. Exactly what you're describing is exactly what takes place. The females all go to the very top males, who the very top male has no conception of female beauty. Every female is equally attractive, and he's going to service every one of them that comes. And the females are the ones that evolved equipment for detecting differences between the males in terms of their attractiveness. So it is the females that first evolved the concept of beauty, not males. Now, in our species, what happened was the following, and it has happened 100 times in mammals, or 100 current mammals do this. And that is that in the original situation, what's happening is that all that they are going to get from the top male is DNA. They're not going to get anything else. There's
no commitment, no resources,
no diamond rings, nothing. Not even a cheap onyx ring. Nothing will happen. Okay, they're not going to lift a claw to help that female. All they are is grandstanding and mating. This is rock star behavior. So this is actually, we call this the He-Man strategy. So throughout nature, the He-Man strategy is, in fact, the most common mating strategy that you're going to see on Earth. Now, it's going to turn out that in certain species where it turns out to be valuable to do a great deal of provisioning of offspring, you're going to find out that the He-Man strategy has a competitive strategy, which is going to be what we're going to call a pair bond strategy, or human beings call it love, or true love strategy. And that is that the females are going to try to find the best male they can find who will also commit a great deal of resources to her and her offspring. And so this is what has happened in human life in the last 2 million years. Prior to 2 million years ago, proto-humans lived the He-Man strategy. But starting about 2 million years ago, that changed. And we have clear evidence that humanoids became pair bond strategy reproducers. And that gave rise to males then evolving for the first time preferences for females. So if you're going to commit to one female, or one female at a time at least, what you're going to do is you're going to start to be very discriminating for the first time. So modern females are all twisted up about how discriminating males are about female beauty. However, it was in fact females discriminating over male beauty that started the whole thing. Today we have mutual high discrimination in humans between both males and females are highly discriminating, and the difficulty that people have in finding romantic relationships is that the people on the other side of the on the other side of the trade are highly discriminating, and it's very difficult to get two sides happy about a deal.
It seems to me that the desire for commitment doesn't really come up until a few dates in. Whose idea? I guess whose idea was that? Is you know, I have friends on both sides. I have guy friends who date women, and they don't really have the talk about relationships until way down the line, and then they say, "Oh, you know what? I'm not really looking." And then I have female friends who, on the other side, they're kind of like hoping that the guy will commit to them, and then it's just kind of, it's a big mess nowadays. It seems to me that with the availability of social media and the very easy online dating platforms, this becomes a bit more challenging to differentiate what exactly we are looking for.
Everybody knows what's going on. Okay, these are ancient Stone Age problems. This is basically, this reminds me of young children learning to play blackjack or poker for the first time. And as they learn, you know, that three kings is a good hand, they're all excited when they get three kings. And so you look at a 12-year-old that's relearning this game, and they're all excited about this, and they discover bluffing, and they think that this is just, you know, this wonderful new thing in life, when the truth is they've been playing poker for a hell of a long time. And so in the same way, this very same game has been going on for 2 million years. And the game is this. Women are out to get the fanciest male genes that they can possibly get. But they want them under the conditions where the male is going to commit to them. Now, they may be willing to take those great genes without any commitment, because they could then pass on superlative genes to their sons, who could make use in the next generation of the very same characteristic that sometimes females are willing to take on males that are extremely attractive, without provisioning them. So the grand prize of nature for humans is an extremely attractive male, because an extremely attractive male can mate basically indiscriminately with high-quality females and not put out any commitment energy. So an extremely attractive male might sire 5,000 children in a lifetime, probably wouldn't, because pregnancy rates are not that high per population in humans. So, but they damn well might sire a couple of hundred. Would be very probable in a highly attractive male. So that is one thing that can be. So remember, the female in her head is looking for the fanciest thing that she can get her hands on. However, she understands that the fanciest thing that she can get her hands on is not going to commit to her in all probability. So so what she's looking for is to split the difference between, think of a woman with two options on her hand. She's got, you know, Errol Flynn on the one hand, that has slept with everything in the world, who would, if he impregnated her, her child would be fancier than herself. On the other hand, she can go with Horace the bank teller, who's a dweeb, and yet Horace follows her around and worships the ground she walks on. And Horace is never going to look at another woman, even when that woman walks by and nobody's watching him. He's so intimidated by his mate's superiority that he is transfixed into being her slave, okay? So let's just think about those two opposite poles. So where does the woman want to land? She wants to land a little closer to Errol Flynn than to Horace. The excitement comes with the fancy male, and the safety comes with the dull male, and she's looking to split the difference between these two to get the very most exciting male she can get her hands on that will also commit. So she evolves mechanisms to try to detect commitment cues out of males. Males have evolved techniques to try to charm their way past the female's ability to detect commitment cues. So the males have learned to lie, and the females have learned to detect the lying, And this is an evolutionary arms race between male and female on this dimension. So when people are meeting today, everybody knows what the game is. Okay? That the male, if he's attracted to the female, he would like to sleep with her pretty much as fast as he can. Now, if it turns out that male is essentially playing one of two mating strategies if he finds her attractive, he is either playing the He-Man strategy, at which point he would sleep with her, but he wants to have absolutely no energy and commitment involved. He's not doesn't want to commit any resources to her. Or he is playing Parabon strategy, where he is willing to commit the rest of the resources of his life to her. So at first meet, that male isn't sure what he's up to. And we believe that sometimes he knows. In other words, very often the male knows that this woman is not Parabon material. She's not fancy enough for him. Males are willing to sleep down in response to the opportunity for casual mating. The males want to sleep up when it comes to Parabon strategy. The exact opposite is true of females. These are the mirror images of each other. The human female will only sleep up in response to casual mating strategy situations. She is willing to sleep down for Parabon considerations. That's because a Parabon can be not as fancy as her in terms of sexiness, but he's going to bring resources to the table to even it out. And so this is really a two-factor equation that is being played over and over again in human genetics. It is resources and sexiness, or what we're going to call gene quality. And that is the dynamic, and everybody knows it. Everybody knows it, but they don't quite put their finger on it. This is why that it is a mathematical certainty that most of the people that you are interested in will never be interested in you, and that why most of the people that are interested in you, you will never be interested in. This is true if you are a two. The ones are really interested in you, and the threes are not interested in you. If you're a five, the fours are really interested in you, and the sixes are not. And all the way up and down the chain, everybody faces the same constraints except the people in the top two or three percentile. And they are in a unique situation where most of the people that they are interested in are also interested in them. They live remarkable lives relative to the rest of us, and I hate them all. I only hate the males.
If the people that we are attracted to are likely never going to be attracted to us and vice versa, how do we find happiness in the mating dance?
Well, it isn't that it can't happen. It just means it's statistically not likely to happen. So in any given, in other words, most of the people that let's take a given guy who's a six. So he's 60th percentile. He's slightly better looking than average. This guy is going to be interested in a lot of people that are north of him on the food chain. And so it's going to be the case that they, because they can see what he is and they know what they are, most of them are not going to be interested in him. So, but that isn't going to be true 100% of the time. Once in a while, somebody's going to take a shine to him that is north of him. And there's a good chance he'll be interested back. So there is that dynamic percolates around inside the system. This is going to be what I call the subjectivity within the objectivity. In other words, sexiness, I can remember reading the classic book that educated the world's biologists about the nature of reality. It's called The Selfish Gene by Richard Dawkins. It was written in 1976. And I didn't read it till a second edition came out in 1989. And when I read this, there was a shocking statement sitting right in there in that book, very unapologetically, as you'd expect out of a theoretical biologist, where Dawkins is talking point blank and openly about the critical importance of sexual attractiveness. Nothing like this was anywhere in the world of psychology, and I had a PhD in the field. And yet here was a biologist simply saying, look, this is where all the action is. So and of course, everybody's terrified of the fact that sexual attractiveness is highly objective. So from the time we're little kids, everybody's saying, oh, everybody's beautiful, there's a cover for every pot, and essentially that this is all like, you know, it's all subjective. And this is like just entirely bullshit, and everybody knows it. So the political correctness and fear about calling a spade in this arena is staggering. And yet, you know, the world gives lip service to it because it's somehow not nice to talk this the way that I'm talking. But it is the way it is. And there is tremendous objectivity in sexual attractiveness. When it comes to facial attractiveness, the correlation coefficients between any two raters looking at faces on a scale of dimensions from the first percentile to the 99th percentile, the correlation coefficients are about 0.94. In other words, they're almost perfect. Okay? There's almost perfect agreement between any two raters. Now, you and I know that that's not true because you and I have looked at pairs of people, and you and I will have disagreed from time to time. But so 0.94 is not perfect, but it's close. Okay? So it would never be the case that I'm looking at somebody that I'm calling them a 9, and you're looking at that same person and you're calling them a 6. That will never happen. Okay?
Right, but I can be around somebody who maybe you might call a 9 or a 10 or something, and they might be facially attractive, but they're really argumentative, they're not really pleasant to be around, they're rude, they sure. smell bad, you know, all these things. Yes. I can't believe that it's just gene mutations that play here.
There's also gene variances that's involved. So what we're seeing is the following. When it comes to human mating, there's an awful lot of factors. It's fundamentally genes and resources. However, what the quote genes are, and remember, for example, when you think about a personality dimension that's super important, in fact, the most attractive personality dimension in the world for men and women both is agreeableness. That winds up being the number one thing that is sought by mates worldwide. Now, let's think about why that is. The reason why that would be true would be because resource sharing and willingness to be generous with resources, including your own time and energy, and to be sensitive to conflicts of interest over resources, which are going to include time and energy, are going to be critical features of a pair bond that is going to face an awful lot of difficulties across child raising. And so it turns out that you know, what you might not think of as a resource, a question, is. Okay, so agreeableness is actually a resource question that human preferences are trying to ferret out. So, yes, it isn't just the way somebody looks that determines their attractiveness. It's going to turn out that our attraction to people is going to wind around different neural circuits. So, for example, lust circuits are going to be in response to body characteristics, whereas attraction to who they are as a person will wind up being different circuits. Now, these circuits all of them can result in people being more and less exciting or pleasant to be with sexually and to be physically close with. But they appear to have evolved at different times in human natural history, and they have different characteristics to what it is that it feels like. So you can be drawn and attracted to someone's smile who you know who they are as a person, and you feel very warmly toward them, but you may never feel strongly sexually attracted to them because of the shape of her lower body features, that she just may not have very attractive rear end and legs. And so you may be very attracted to the human, but not very attracted to her sexually, whereas someone else who you know is just a total bitch is someone that has a physical shape that you always find very attractive. That's because those two characteristics of human experience are actually different neural circuits that evolved under different genes controlling them.
Would females rather choose a less agreeable male versus a more agreeable male?
Yes, there's certainly that characteristic. So females in general are going to want males that are bigger than they are, stronger than they are, and more disagreeable than they are. And the question is, how much disagreeable can you stand before it becomes intolerable and you feel like it's going to get turned on you? And so you want to see, and there are significant individual differences that are involved here. So if you yourself are an absolute hard-bitten, tough, testosteronized female, you might want to wimp, okay, because you know you're tough enough to take care of yourself. So this is there are nuances and individual differences that wind up playing through this game, but these are definitely some of the pieces to the puzzle here that go on in human romance and man-woman dynamics.
In terms of agreeable, disagreeable, my understanding of this is kind of how people feel fair about the relationships. Almost like it doesn't have to be 50-50, but it has to feel 50-50. So some people are about 55-45, some people about 60-40, some people are 40-60, and the more disagreeable ones are something like 70-30 in their favor. Is that what we mean by agreeable and disagreeable?
Yeah, that's a very good way to conceptualize that. So disagreeable people tend to be more testosteronized, and they tend to be less empathic. They tend to be less sensitive towards other people's needs because they're focused on the fact that, in general, they feel like they're getting chiseled. And so there's a general irritable quality to them the higher you go up in the disagreeable testosteronized chain. On the mirror image, it's very sweet people. Just don't want to fight for anything and concede at the drop of a hat. Those are people on the other side.
And those are the most fun people to kind of be enter into any type of relationship, romantic or otherwise?
Not necessarily. The thing is that those people come with their own expenses. So let's suppose you marry some gal who's just sweet as anything. But the problem is that she is being taken advantage of at her workplace, at church. She's, they're asking her to do this and do that. And she basically can't say no because she's so agreeable that she winds up being stretched and overwhelmed by life. And so that impacts you as her mate. So there are, the truth of the matter is that the most adaptive people, all things considered, are somewhat near the middle of the bell curve. And as you get either highly disagreeable or highly agreeable, those come with substantial costs that are associated with those. You know, you are what you are, but it's useful to know if you happen to be, for example, very agreeable, that it pays to figure out how to engineer your way around some of those characteristics so that you don't incur too much expense in dealing with people.
Yeah, and the reason I'm thinking about this is someone's a little too agreeable. And let's say from both sides. Let's say it's a female who's not too agreeable. I'd say just lower on the in terms of more agreeable than most people. And they're entering into a relationship with the male who they're assuming is going to be committed, and they agree and everything. But then the male who's sharing some of the resources and ends up cheating and ends up getting another mistress and all those kind of mess. On the other side, you can have a very agreeable male who is able to commit resources to a very beautiful female, and they both have a great relationship until the baby comes and the male realizes, oh, guess what? It's not his kid. And the female has actually, been enjoying the company of a more disagreeable, of a higher, I guess, quality male, and he's been committing resources. So on both sides, how common is this? What's the deal in that scenario?
This situation is very common, just as a backdrop in human affairs. This is a percolating potential that sits inside of any relationship where things can get tipped out of balance by a variety of factors. So we're not going to say that this is happening all the time everywhere, but it's a percolating low grade threat that is always there, and this is a problem in any case where people are, where the trade is out of balance and someone is being over-rewarded. So the situation could for an agreeable female can be she can be in a relationship with a hard-driving, testosteronized male, and she can feel excited and more secure in some ways, but that by virtue of his toughness, but that could be a ticking time bomb. If it turns out to be the case that he comes upon more resources or comes into situations where he wants to essentially play casual mating strategy in life or move on. So that is a, you know, certainly these dynamics can happen in any combination, but that is a not uncommon thing that happens in human relationships. On the other side, what happens less frequently but absolutely is there is that males who are over-rewarded in terms of their physical attractiveness with because of their, particularly their modern ability to get resources. So you have non-alpha, non-tough males with some brains that in the modern environment wind up being brilliantly rewarded. Let's say a guy makes $200,000 a year, and the average guy in the United States makes about 40. So our Mr. $200,000 a year, really, you know, he can't put a post hole to build a fence and straight. But what he can do is he can cut out gallbladders. So he's pretty nifty, and he might make five times or 10 times what the average guy makes. And so a rather slightly crafty female might be willing to trade down in the looks department 10 or 20% or more than 10%. Let's call it 30. So let's suppose our boy is a 6 and she's a 9. Now that may work. Depends upon what her psychology is like. He could be elated that he gets himself a 9, and she could be completely fine, and that might work, but it might not work. And so there's a tendency when relationships are significantly mismatched for them to come apart. And absolutely, females in those situations are very often sleeping with the tennis pro. But this happens. This is a potential of what goes on in human life.
Is there any way to guard against that on the male side and on the female side?
Well, I think that, I would say that the following is true. And this is easy to say this, you know, from a psychologist that has been watching this at close range in thousands of people for three decades. So it's maybe easy for me to say this, but if people are honest and true to themselves and really are not letting themselves get giddy over situations, but instead taking their time, not rushing into decisions, and being square with the person in the mirror, you can sniff a lot of this coming. So I have observed, as Joni Mitchell would say, some hot, hot blazes that go down to smoke and ash. And I could see them coming. And I only met these people three times. And yet I could tell this is trouble. This is a mismatch situation. There is some sort of untoward deal making that's going on here, and people are highly attractive person is being lazy and irresponsible with their life and trading down because they're a flake, and the less attractive person can see it, but is so enamored with getting the good looks that they're going to do it anyway. And that this thing is a volcano that's going to blow sooner or later, and I've seen it and I've watched it happen, and I have seen situations where nice guys have gotten into situations where they really didn't want to be, and there might not have been some big mismatch, but they were not happy, and they were getting trapped, and the female's anxiety was that she was damn well determined to trap them. And I've seen that situation go on and known that the wrong thing to do was to stay married and to have children. And I've watched those things blow up or just end in long-term like misery. So what can I say? You know, what we're seeking for, well, we can talk about mating and males and females and testosterone and estrogen and beauty and mutations. But the truth is that ideally what people are trying to find is love. What they're trying to find is a situation that inherently feels like a very, very solid, excellent trade. And it doesn't feel like, quote, a trade. It just feels like something that you want to do. And the and that is possible for people, but it is not easy. And we wouldn't expect it to be easy. It's just in the same way as to find your ideal job and career is not easy. It's not easy to find an excellent partner that you might be with for a large portion of your lifetime. And however, it's not a game for the lazy, and it's not a game for those that lack courage. It's not a game for the gutless, and it's not the game for the impatient. You have to be patient. You have to be determined. You have to be make the most of your own self. I have a good friend who said, the job here is to turn yourself into the most perfect mate you can, and then act naturally. You're not selling anybody anything. You're just being you. And the desire to try to get there by shortcuts and to various kinds is the biggest thing that that will keep people between them and a satisfying life in this domain.
Well said. The important thing is to kind of be the best version of yourself and strive to achieve your genetic potential in a lot of different ways. You're saying, Dr. Lyle, that things like keeping in good shape, making sure that you're intellectually attractive, making sure that you are as attractive as you can be physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, all those things.
All of those things. And, you know, you can't be, this doesn't mean being out of breath with high blood pressure, trying to be as ferociously competitive as possible with every minute of your life. But it does mean not being lazy and not overlooking things where we know where if we put in effort, we could put a better foot forward. You want to put a very good version of yourself in front of the opposite sex. You don't have to be perfect.
All right. Well, thank you again, Dr. Lyle. We'd love to have you come back and talk a little bit more about better dynamics. We kind of got off topic talking about dating and love, but I love it. I love this topic. It's one of a really interesting topic for me. And we're hoping to get you back here again, maybe to talk about personality characteristics. A couple years ago, by your recommendation, I read a book by Jeffrey Miller called Spent, talking about all the different personality characteristics that people have. And it boils down to about 5 plus 1, which is intelligence. So we'd love to have you come on and discuss that and what that means for different goals that we are trying to accomplish.
Absolutely. Great fun, and I look forward to it.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.